The Women's Podcast, brought to you by Rabo Direct, the straight talking savings bank.
Well, you're all very welcome back to the Women's Podcast, coming to you from the Rotunda Hospital in the heart of Dublin City. Are you all going to give a round of applause or not? OK, we have a very obedient audience, which is a great start. And this is our first Women's Podcast look at the 1916 commemorations. First, a reminder that you can subscribe to this award-winning podcast on iTunes, Stitcher and on SoundCloud. And you can always find us on irishtimes.com. You can always go to iTunes, subscribe and then write a review of the podcast because we always like hearing what you think, unless there is foul language involved. There's been a lot of that in the past few weeks, so let's avoid that. It's always good to get the Women's Podcast out of the office, and there is something entirely apt about sitting here in the Rotunda Hospital, one of this country's best-known medical institutions. I don't know if I'm, is it because I'm so old, but I remember being at a Bruce Springsteen concert years ago. Born in the USA. Does anybody remember this?
Yes.
Born in the Rotunda. And it also starred in The Snapper, which is one of my very favourite movies of all time. Since the mid-1700s, which is well over 250 years, I think, the Rotunda has cared for women and babies here in Parnell Square, where, of course, it had a unique view of the rising, being slap-bang in the middle of it all. We've set up shop here in the pillar room, a little bit away from all the noisy action on the maternity wards. But babies and women and the glorious and gut-wrenching birthing experience would be very much in our minds as we look back on the role played by this hospital and Holles Street Hospital and women in general during the 1916 rising. So why are we here now? Well, from Monday, March the 7th to Thursday, March 31st, the Rotunda Hospital is celebrating this place with the Birth of a Nation, an exhibition that will showcase the lives of five extraordinary medical women of 1916 for the very first time, 100 years on. Through a series of never-before-seen images, diaries and video footage, the public will be introduced to the women of the rising at the Rotunda who went on to become important figures in Irish medical history. But before we get into all of that, I want to give you the answers to this week's very appropriate question. We wanted to know what single item you'd advise a woman that she simply had to pack to bring with her when coming in to have a baby. And we got some great responses on Facebook and Twitter at IT Women's Podcast. Dr. Rona Mahoney is laughing here and she's going to have to answer the question herself later on. This one is from Miranda, which is not her real name, and you'll soon see why she wanted to change it. She writes, she's actually quite disgusting, "My maternity must-have was Kotex nighttime towels. Bring dozens because no one, no matter how much gunk they imagine you emit, will buy mattresses big enough. And while you're at it, disposable knickers, because no one, no matter how much they love you, will thank you for sending them to Mother Care to buy those. I shudder at the memory." Then there's Yvonne Brady. "Hi there. Bendy straws are a maternity hospital bag essential for when you're in the throes of labour and find a good position but are gasping for water and don't want to move your head. They were invaluable to me 6 weeks ago when I had my baby girl. Congratulations, Yvonne." Breed Dunn emailed us on the Women's Podcast at irishtimes.com. She's a PhD student in occupational therapy at the University of Limerick and sits beside a midwifery researcher. On the subject of what to bring in your overnight bag, Breed writes, "I have no children but do hope to have them one day. I'm fairly sure that staying away from raw milk, cheese while pregnant is going to be very tough." Now, she has awful problems, hasn't she? "I'm deeply in love with cheese. And I feel like that's going to be a huge challenge for me. So when the time hopefully comes, I think a small wheel of camembert and crackers is going to be an essential part of my kit. Though I'd really love a home birth." Sorry, Rona. "So maybe I can just stick it in the fridge." Sarah Trainer from County Meath said, "I'm heading into Hotel Rotunda for my fourth baby in June. My advice if you're staying in a public ward is earplugs. They are essential. If you arrive in early labour, you're on a ward for a couple of hours or more, and you'll be so happy to have those earplugs when the woman in the next bed is on her fifth loud phone call while you're trying to do what the hypnobirthing tape said. It's also very hard to stay in the zone when there's someone howling in agony next to you or worse." Actually, I remember my obstetrician was very mean to me and told me to stop shouting. It was upsetting everybody.
Oh,
I'm sure you're not like that.
Mean.
Rona, it was horrible. Anyway, also she objected to them texting without the key tones turned off, so she was obviously feeling quite irritable at the time. Also, afterwards, if you've laboured all night and are safely back in the ward with baby sleeping next to your partner, husband, standing guard, there is no nicer feeling than sticking the earplugs in and pulling the blanket over your head for an hour. Sarah, call me a freak, but I believe in earplugs 24/7, actually. And my memories are from a long time ago, and that's the product of the first one. But it involved calling for a swimming ring. You know, the baby children swimming rings. Yeah, they probably are much more sophisticated accoutrements now. Yeah. And a scattering, an absolutely staggering number of baby grows. That's what I remember, having to keep calling in for more baby grows. But I also remember that blissful tea and toast immediately after the birth. And they've turned into my lifelong comfort food. Thank you for all the responses. I'll tell you next week's question at the end of this episode. Now, later on in the show, you're going to hear from the head librarian of the Rotunda, Anne O'Byrne, and from historian in 1916, Boffin Mary McAuliffe. And we are also delighted to have with us the first female master of the National Maternity Hospital, Dr. Rona Mahoney, who travelled all the way across the river from Holestry to be with us on the Women's Podcast. But we are going to begin this 1916 Birth of a Nation episode with some music, and we are delighted to be joined by a Dublin band who, it's fair to say, had a slightly less straightforward entry into the world, given they were part of a multiple birth. Heathers were formed in 2007 by twin sisters Ellie and Louise McNamara, and the following year they recorded their acclaimed debut album, Here, Not There, while preparing for their leaving cert. Precocious McNamaras. They are known for their unique blend of harmonies, and one of their best-known songs is Remember When, which I think cracked hearts on that gorgeous Bord Fáilte ad. But first, given the night that's in it, we have to ask you, Heathers, where were you born?
We were born in Hollis Street Hospital, and we were 2 months premature, so we spent quite a while in Hollis Street. Our mum went straight back to work and used to come down. She worked down by the canal, and she'd walk down on her lunch breaks to visit us every day.
How long were you kept in for?
I think, was it a month, Louise?
I think nearly 2 months.
Nearly 2 months, yeah. Now,
Dr. Manny, they prove that premature babies aren't necessarily small people, don't they?
Not at all. They can really grow up, as you can see.
Yes.
But that'll be a great start, you know.
Yes. Heathers are here to sing their latest song, November. And will you please give a warm Women's Podcast Birth of a Nation welcome to them, Heathers.
It was a cold, cold night that evening back in November when I called. For some adventure when I realized that you're searching for more, oh, and the world is a mysterious place. It can work in your favor, it can work in strange ways. Oh, you left me in the cold out the winter. Out on my own. Oh, you left me in the cold up the winter when my heart was heavy. You were gone, gone, gone. It was a cold, cold night that evening back in November when I called. Temper never be the same, never feel like it always before. Oh, and the world is a mysterious place. It can work in your favor, it can work in strange ways. Oh, you left in the cold. was out on my own. Oh, you left in the cold of the winter when my heart was heavy. You were gone, gone, gone. And I'm lost now in the silence of the snowfall in the summer.
What a privilege. What a great performance. Thank you, Heathers, twin sisters Ellie and Louise McNamara. Thank you very much. Now, our first guest today is Anne O'Byrne, head librarian at the Rotunda Hospital. You probably never knew there was such a post, but there is indeed, and she's putting it to fantastic use. She's a graduate of the University of Wales, and her extensive career in health sciences libraries began at the Dublin Dental School and University Hospital, Trinity College, where she developed Ireland's first dental library for undergraduate dentistry. Bet you never knew that existed. But obviously a very great help to our young dentists, I presume. Anne.
I hope so.
Yes. Her role as custodian of historical memorabilia has expanded during her term as librarian in the Rotunda, and she developed the Bartholomew Moss Tercentenary exhibition a few years ago to mark Moss's life as founder of the first lying-in hospital, which of course is the very one we are in this evening. Anne, you are very welcome to the Women's Podcast. And first of all, where were you born?
Well, I wasn't born in Dublin. I was actually born in Tipperary, Tipperary town. So I'm a Munster lady. I'm a half-twin.
Of Munster.
And my mother was a half-twin and her mother. We're half-twins because none of our siblings actually lived. So
that's, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Well, it's also a fact of birth at different points, particularly in multiple births, I presume, yeah.
Yeah, which is worth reminding ourselves on.
True, yes.
On a day like this. There must have been a hospital in Tipperary, was there?
Yes, it actually was a nursing home, so because nursing home facilities, there were different levels of nursing home facility at the time, other than hospital, other than maternity.
Yeah. Yeah, because back in the day, we might talk about that, actually, there was a huge tradition, especially in middle-class families, I think, of being born in nursing homes. Anyway, we'll come back to that. Anne, will you take us to the origins of the Rotunda? Tell us a little bit about it and about Bartholomew Moss.
Certainly, yes. The Rotunda Hospital, as we know it today, owes its existence to the vision, drive, energy, and sheer heroism of one extraordinary man. He was our founder, and he opened the first purpose-built maternity hospital in the world in 1754. And as Cathy says, it was called the Lying-In Hospital. And basically, it was a culmination of his life's work, a humanitarian project which ultimately saved the lives of countless women and their newborns. And that's the thing to remember from the outset. He further supported the role of women in education through his advancement of midwifery practice. This was very unusual because in medical levels, midwifery was frowned upon at that time. And Moss himself became licensed as a midwife in 1742, and this was to add accreditation and credibility to the role long before we required accredited systems. He could have ignored the plight of less fortunate women and children of Dublin. Nobody would have blamed him for that. His social status was sufficient that he could have lived differently. The compassion he showed to women of the slums is mirrored in the work of these medical women that we hope to honour in our exhibition here at the Rotunda. And we hope you will all come and see it when we open. But let me bring you to 1916, which is really the subject of the environment that these women lived and worked in.
Yes, Anne, because the bullets were flying, there was another kind of blood, sweat and tears going on in the Rotunda, which never closed. And the women kept on coming in to give birth in the middle of the raging battle.
It was standard practice of the day, and they continued to work and deliver and to invite the public into through all the turmoil and the strife, to invite them in to give birth. Yes. There are some contrasting landscapes that we should look at. There was destitution in the slums versus wealth and privilege, totally evident in 1916. There was squalor, overcrowded conditions, and it claimed the lives of mothers and babies routinely. And that's a horrendous thing to say nowadays, because it was routine. Over 500 deaths per 100,000 were recorded in 1916. If we were to look at it today, thankfully, we would only record 10 per 100,000. Also, you have to remember and place it in context that easily treatable conditions, general infections, blood clots, hemorrhaging, did not have the advantage of antibiotics or blood transfusions. So simple things and simple interventions weren't available. So the rate of mortality changed as a result. Infant mortality in 1916 was 160 per 1,000 births. Today, we are lucky to say it's 3 per 1,000. So they're quite sobering figures, really.
And this is the environment in which these amazing women worked.
Absolutely,
and
yes.
This is where Bartholomew Moss was going when he recognised the need, the desperate need for a facility like this.
He had actually lost his first wife and child to childbirth. And that's where it struck him in a very personal way. And he felt we should do something to improve the plight of women in what was routine birth, yes.
And we're celebrating these women, but in the meantime, before we get to them, Anne,
yes,
we had these women who were trying to get to the Rotunda to give birth. I mean, what do we know about them? How did they get here? Because from what we see of the reenactments, O'Connell Street was in flames. There were snipers on roofs all over the place.
Well, you have to remember you have a multidisciplinary group coming to the Rotunda, as you do today. They were different in terms of religion, even though the Rotunda was predominantly a Protestant institution. But Catholic women delivered in the Rotunda as well, as a norm. But they would have probably at this time be forced to do some on foot. But the poor would have come on foot anyway. Mm. There were no trams running because of the turmoil. If you remember where you are this minute, if you walk out our side entrance here, you're going to be at the top of O'Connell Street. And the GPO is only a stone's throw away. So they had to get through that.
Yes.
The conditions in the slums, and Rona can support me on this, wouldn't have been any better. The mother would still have risked her life coming to the Rotunda in the hope of a better delivery and a safer delivery.
So when they got here, they would have encountered some of these amazing women you're going to tell us about.
Yes, they would, yeah. Mm.
And starting with Bridget Lyons Thornton.
Yes, some of these women, I think, will be known to some of you quite a lot. Some won't. Some we've discovered more about in our exploration since September when we started. But I'm only giving you a synopsis tonight because I do want you to come to the exhibition as well. Footfall is very important, folks. Bridget Lyons Thornton. I have to credit one of our anaesthetists, Dr. Pat Thornton, with the original discussions on Bridget Lyons Thornton. And when he came to me originally, I had very little information about Bridget Lyons, and We started working together in this exploration. She described herself as a rebel, a soldier, and a doctor. But she was a medical student at the time of the Rising, and she gave assistance at Father Matthew Hall and in the forecourts. She was arrested also for a short time and held in Kilmainham Jail.
And so she was the first female army officer of the Free State.
She was, that's right. And that was quite an unusual thing. We researched her records and her career in the army and her pension records afterwards. Her association with the Rotunda continued through her work as a paediatrician and long after she retired, for one real reason. She's accredited as being the first librarian of the Rotunda.
Oh my, you come from a fine tradition.
Absolutely, yes, yes. I claim her anyway, folks. That's for certain.
And Kathleen Lynn.
Yes, Kathleen.
Well known to us.
Lynn needs no introduction to most of us. She was at the City Hall garrison. She was immersed in the Rising as a chief medical officer with the Irish Citizen Army. She was deported for a time also. What is less known is that she is an alumni of the Rotunda. And in our research, we discovered that she had undertaken midwifery training at the Rotunda. And we have a very nice group photo that we discovered from 1916 showing her in that role. And we're going to exhibit that for the first time. We're also sharing it with the Royal College of Physicians because they have a Kathleen Lynn collection. We cannot claim her totally because obviously she was a founder of St. Dalton's, which was the first children's hospital in Dublin. So, but our associations are clear from this research.
She was one mighty woman. And one thing I love about her, according to this, Anne, she described herself as a Red Cross doctor and a belligerent to her arresting officer. Isn't that a great word? I think we should adopt that. Next up, Dorothy Stopford Price. These women have great names, actually, haven't they?
Absolutely, yes. Her maternal grandfather was Every Kennedy, who was a master of the Rotunda, and his image lies in our front hall at the moment. She was a committed member of Cumann na mBan, and she devoted her life to medicine and paediatrics in particular. She's a very interesting character because at the time of the Rising, it was described that she was seen coming out of the district at any time of the day or night. Now, what that means is the district is the forerunner of our community services that still runs in this day in the Rotunda. So regardless of turmoil or her own safety, she went out with her bag of instruments and delivered out in the community, yeah.
Day and night, obviously. And fascinatingly, Anne was the first person to use the BCG vaccine in Ireland.
That's right, yes. And she her interest in tuberculosis was a very personal one because she developed TB and she spent a time in France where she met her husband, convalescing. Mm. So she had a real interest in eradicating TB for the people of Ireland, really.
Well, it's nice to hear that some of her work paid off and in a personal way, isn't it?
Mm.
Yes, that she met. Now, the next woman, I adore her name. She was Albinia Broderick, and her father was the 8th Viscount Middleton. And when she came to Ireland in 1905, Anne, she became known as Gubnet ni Vruther.
Yes.
Did you ever wonder where the name Gubnet came from? I don't think it came from Albinia, but anyway. Tell us about Albinia.
She equally undertook her midwifery training at the Rotunda in 1905. She was a qualified nurse. But the striking thing apart from that was that she was so moved by her experiences in the Rising and in treating patients during 1916, that in the conflict that followed in the Free State afterwards, she visited internment camps, and she provided medical care there also. So that was a direct result of her experience in 1916.
Yes. And she had, again, amazingly, someone, Anne, who actually came from a very, very comfortable background, 15 servants in Belgravia, etc.
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, what do we know about what brought her to Ireland? What was she thinking? Really? What was she thinking?
Well, she obviously was humanitarian, and she was able to see past her stature and her living conditions to see the the people.
Was there no need in London? I mean, did she not see need around her there? What was it about us that attracted a woman like her, do you think?
Our warmth, I suppose, yes.
Do you think?
I would, yes.
That's very nice. Mary O'Shea.
I have fallen in love with Mary O'Shea, which is why I've probably left the goods till last. And that is because Mary O'Shea is a very real person. Not saying our medics aren't, and apologies to our qualified people. But you will love Mary O'Shea because she did her nursing training in England and she had only come back to Ireland to train as a midwife in the Rotunda when the Rising started. And she was present here in our round room during the Rising and during the time that members of the Rising were taken by the British on our grounds. So she has a unique place, really. The one thing I would say about her, and if you'll bear with me, I'll read you her memoir, is that at no time did this 22-year-old ever feel that she wasn't equipped to do a job. She was only in training. Okay, she had lived abroad for a short period of time from the time she was younger. But at no time did she feel, I shouldn't be here. I'll go back to Abbey Leaks. Abbey Leaks is where she came from, and my courtesy to the Abbey Leaks Heritage Company for giving us the story. We've collaborated in a film which will be showing during the exhibition, and I think everyone will enjoy that. But Mary is quite unique in the way she looked at life, the responsibility she showed, I suppose work ethic we'd call it today. Certainly not the norm for a 22-year-old.
And before you read Mary's memoir to us, can you put in context the Rotunda's place in the Rising? The leaders were arrested and rounded up in what's called the yard of the Rotunda, is that correct?
Well, it's our front car park as it is now, the front gardens. There were two gardens, there was a rear garden, the pleasure gardens, and then there was a front garden, yeah. It is reported that McDonough was stripped there. And the memoir indicates that Mary O'Shea was one of the staff who witnessed that from a window over our round room.
So you're now going to read Mary O'Shea's memoir, and which I think she recorded in 1966 as part of the commemorations back then. Am I right about that?
That's right. Yes, it is.
Okay.
You'll have to bear with me, everyone. I'm not an actress, but I'm going to give it as much feeling as I can.
Go for it, Anne.
Easter week 1916 seemed so unreal that now it seems like a nightmare. Here was I doing night duty as part of my training in the Rotunda Hospital. At the time, I was doing special work on an isolation ward with a mania patient. It was not a nice job, as patients were kept under sedation during the day, and the unfortunate night nurse had to put up with everything during night hours. I spent 2 years in France, saw the start of the 1914-18 war, enough to put me off wars forever. It was with great joy I returned to Ireland to peace, quiet, and happiness. I thought my head would burst with joy when I saw dear old Ireland rising up out of the sea with the morning sun shining down on her. After a short spell at home, I went to Dublin. Up to this time in the country, we took part in everything, Irish, language, singing and dancing. But at no time did we hear of anything militant. Easter Sunday, we all attended our various religious duties. Monday, we sat at our windows looking out at gay crowds, going to the races and enjoying their freedom. Bed and try to sleep in a room to the front of the house looking at Parnell, dominated by O'Connell Street. Funny how one can get used to the noise. It was like a lullaby, something like background music. A door banging in the hospital or something falling would wake one up, but never the rumble. I waked up and I was still quite bright. What on earth was happening? There was not a sound in the street and nobody seemed to be moving. What an extraordinary state of affairs was my first thought. I could only sit pretty until the night duty called. The volunteers have taken over Dublin, was the news. We followed routine and we betook ourselves to our various posts. Soon there was noise enough, but not the placid everyday hum of ordinary movement. Shots and explosions were the order of the day. We did our work, ate our short rations, and sleep when we could. The British military were stationed in the hospital. The orders we got: do your work, do not go out of doors, and keep away from the windows. Leave the thought that most of the city had been blown up into fragments. It looked as if we were in the centre of a huge bonfire, which would close in on us at any moment. The room in which I was with my patient was just above the round room. Bullets began to hop off the casing of the windows. We were moved to a room in the middle of the building in which there was another patient of the same kind and another nurse on special duty. This was better, at least, as we had somebody to talk to. We two nurses stood at the window in fascinated horror, wondering when we would get it. The whole sky seemed illuminated. Of course, we could not sleep in the day. We sat huddled together, talking and dozing and wondering. We could not keep away from the windows, in spite of the warnings. We saw several people shot in trying to cross O'Connell Street. They were dragged off the street and put into the morgue. We saw snipers at work from the top of the houses of Parnell Square. We saw all the prisoners collected onto the lawn in the front of the hospital and marched away to prison. One, I think, was the Countess, judging by the size of her small hands and feet. When things got quiet and we went out of doors, a terrible sight met our eyes. O'Connell Street was in shambles. We were all struck dumb, as I don't think anyone in the house had any knowledge of what was going to happen. A conspiracy of silence existed, as nobody knew or understood what the whole business was about. A couple of young fellas from home turned up at the door at the end of the week. I was overjoyed to see them and to learn that everything was quiet down the country. However, work went on and absorbed all our energies and time. Later, I went to England to do my general training and came home from that into the Civil War, which was 1,000 times worse. To think that lads who stood together against a common foe could split and be so bitter. This, to me, is the tragedy of our time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Anne O'Byrne, for bringing that to us, along with the words of the remarkable Mary O'Shea. And didn't she fit an awful lot into a very short piece
Absolutely.
Of literature?
Yes.
Right down to what she said about the Civil War and setting it all in such perspective, because we know that there was a terrible tragedy looming that I presume we'll all be commemorating. We'll be back here again, no doubt, commemorating all that again in a few years' time. And thank you so much. That was right down to the fact that the British military were in this hospital. You know, this hospital really is crammed with history in the most extraordinary way. Now, we have to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be finding out much more about the women of 1916 from our rising expert, Mary McAuliffe. And we'll be hearing from the master of Hollis Street, Rona Mahoney, about many things, including the item she thinks every woman should bring when they're packing for the maternity hospital. We're very curious about that. We'll be back after this.
Amazing how a good discussion can change the way you think about something. At Rabodirect, we like to have conversations that change the way you think about saving and help you reach your savings goals. As straight talkers, there'll be no waffle involved. And as a savings specialist, you can rest assured we'll have a pretty good idea what we're talking about. Rabodirect, the straight talking savings bank.
Our next guest is a well-known historian, and what she doesn't know about the women of 1916 probably isn't worth knowing. In 2014, she coordinated the centenary commemorations of the founding of Cumann na Mban, including a national commemoration at Glasnevin Cemetery and a major conference at Collins Barracks, Dublin. She was also the co-editor with Clara Fisher of a book called Irish Feminisms, Past, Present and Future, which was published last year. Her latest book is We Were There, 77 Women of the Easter Rising. And she contends that as we approach the centenary of 1916, full equality between men and women will be our biggest battle. Who'd have thought it? You are very welcome to the Women's Podcast, Mary McAuliffe.
Thank you very much.
You're a Kerry woman.
I'm a Kerry woman.
So before we go anywhere else, where were you born?
Well, much to the delight of my siblings, because they endlessly tease me about it, I was actually born in Limerick. To my shame.
In a hospital?
In a hospital in Limerick.
And do you still support Munster Rugby?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
See, that's
Kerry,
the important
Kerry football
thing.
And Munster Rugby.
Yes. Yes, very good. Yeah. And you too, I presume. No rugby.
Occasionally, yes, it depends.
Okay, all right. You didn't spend enough time there, obviously.
No.
Okay, Mary, you've talked about the women of 1916 being airbrushed out of the picture. Can you brush them back in for us this evening, especially with reference to the women of this area who would have been involved?
Well, there were over 300 women who fought in the Rising, if you take into account the women in Dublin, in Ashburn, in Enniscorthy and in Galway, all the places where the Rising actually happened. So that's 300 members of Cumann na mBan or the Irish Citizen Army. About, of that 300, almost 200 of them participate here in Dublin. And these are the well-known women, like Countess Markovitch, who wasn't here in the Rotunda when they surrendered, actually. She was over in Stephen's Green. But the British military were absolutely obsessed with finding her. So they kept asking where she was, and maybe Mary heard them looking for her. Or Kathleen Lynn, or Madeleine French Mullen, Elizabeth O'Farrell, who brought the surrender up through gunfire coming from the Rotunda. As she walked up Moore Street to that intersection with Parnell Street, she was dodging bullets that were coming from the machine guns on top of the Rotunda to deliver the surrender. So these women were amazing women. Most of them, outside of that leadership cohort, were young, working-class women born in the inner-city areas of Dublin, from Dominic Street and King's Inn Street and Bolton Street, that, as they are now, and the south inner city as well. So they were born probably either at home or in the Rotunda or in Holles Street. They're true blue dubs.
And Mary, you know, what we hear is that people, that they, a lot of the local people were opposed to the Rising, or they felt very ambivalent about it, I suppose. Where did these women figure in all that? I mean, how did they become what they became? What was it that moved them?
Well, most of them are very young women. Most of them are young, unmarried, working class women or young middle class women. They have been motivated by cultural nationalism. You've quite a few Abbey actors and actresses out in the Rising. Helena Maloney, Sean Connolly, who shot one of the first rebels shot in 1916. Maureen Ishuli, who is the leader of Cumann na mBan in Jacob's factory outpost. They came from the stage to the rebellion. It's a performance in both senses, I suppose. They were informed by feminism and the right of women to get the vote. Remember, women don't even have the vote now. Women are not regarded as full citizens under legislation at this time. And very importantly, for the younger women, particularly the working class, inner city dwelling women, the 1913 lockout and the rights of women workers. Many of them had come out in 1913 on strike as Jacob factory girls. They had joined the Irish Women Workers Union. They had then joined the Irish Citizen Army. So they're motivated by those three. Markovitch called them nationalism, feminism and socialism. And they're coming together, and they believe they want an Ireland that's different from the one they have, in which women have the full and equal position, in which the promises they were given in the proclamation, actually. Yes. At the end of it all.
Those wonderful promises.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary, you looked at 77 of them. Why did you pick that particular 77? Is it a broad spectrum, or what were you thinking?
No, they were self-selecting, actually. Yes. There were 77 of them arrested after the Rising. They were marched off, three of them here. Three of them spent the night on the Rotunda Green, actually, including Julia Grennan, Winifred Kearney, James Connolly's secretary, and another nurse, Catherine Treston. And they were marched off to Richmond Barracks, where they met all the other women who were arrested. Now, many more of the women had evaded capture. They were asked to leave the GPO or the forecourts And had evaded capture and gone home because they were told their work would be necessary after, and it became so. It was very necessary after for reorganisation. But the 77 that Liz Gillis and I, who co-wrote this book, concentrate on are those 77 that were arrested.
Mary, I watched Rebellion.
Rebellion.
Okay, and in the GPO, as far as I can remember, or somewhere, the women were told, a particular woman, a zealot, who was clearly, yes. she was gooey-eyed for Pádraig Pearse, I seem to remember. But he told, was it James Connolly or Pádraig Pearse perhaps, or told her to go back to the kitchen.
Kitchens. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did that actually happen?
Well, yes and no. I wouldn't have been a big fan of Rebellion, actually, myself, even though it concentrated on the women. But what it did was it was ahistorical in the sense of the women's story is amazing without making it what it wasn't. And yes, some of them were told to go into the kitchens, but some of them expected to do that in their training in Cumann na mBan and in the Citizen Army with, for example, Kathleen Lynn. They were given first aid training. They knew they were going to be providing the food supplies. An army marches on its stomach. That was a very necessary thing. And indeed, the only place where they weren't in 1916 was in Boland's Mill, where they were turned away by Eamon de Valera, the commandant there, who later said he regretted it because his men had to spend the week doing the women's job, which was cooking. In actual fact, in Boland's Mill is where the least amount of action happens, really.
Indeed, yes.
But the women, they did. They looked after the food supplies. They looked after the first aid. They did one very important job, and Anne mentioned the fact that Mary O'Shea talked about the danger on O'Connell Street. Some of those women crossed O'Connell Street because it wasn't just the GPO. You had the Imperial Hotel was taken and various other outposts, 30 or 40 times over the week under fire, taking dispatches. And we don't have text messages in 1916 or Snapchat or any of those. What we have are Cumann na mBan women who can take the dispatches hidden in their hair. They won't be searched at the barricades. They look young and innocent and innocuous. And some of them talk about how they went up and told the soldiers that, crying, that some relative was sick and they had to go here, there, or anywhere. And they took the dispatches from the GPO to the forecourts, to City Hall, to College of Surgeons, to Jacobs. They were the communications network. One woman, Catherine Byrne, talks about walking from the GPO to the forecourts, and she had the dispatch hidden in her beret, and she took it off, and there was a bullet hole in the beret. So, you know, they took real risks and real dangers. But as well as that, there were also women who fired guns, who were actually front-line soldiers.
How many of them did that?
There would have been a few. There would have been Margaret Skinner, who led an action, who was wounded four times. When they were leaving City Hall, all the Irish Citizen Army girls or women were given revolvers by James Connolly. He told them not to use them except in case of danger, but they were going into a rising, I think. The situation was demanding anyway. The Inian and the Héireann branch of Cumann na mBan were assisting the South Dublin Union volunteers. Eamon Cant didn't have a lot of people because, of course, with the counterman, not as many turned up as was supposed to. So in each sniper nest at the windows, and they held off the British for quite a few days, he put a man and a woman. And the man was firing the guns and the woman was reloading the other gun. And they would take turns. And if the guy got tired, sometimes the woman went up to the window and fired out the window, including one woman whose name I can't remember, got the gun at one stage, but she fired it into the ceiling. And she said she always wanted to fire a gun in the cause of Ireland, but didn't want to kill anyone. So.
I wish you could remember her name. We'll have to buy the book.
You'll have to buy the book, yes. It's in the book. Yeah.
It's called We Were There, 77 Women of the East Arising. Tell us more.
Well, the title is self-explanatory, and what we were really saying is the women were there. Without them, the rising is a different story. It would be a different history. And their contribution has to be included in the rising. And no more of this airbrushing out or neglecting the story of the women or why they were there. They were. Helena Maloney said, we didn't go out to fight in a rising because of the love of some man or because we wanted to impress somebody.
Which is the big problem with rebellion, wasn't it?
Yes.
Every single
yes.
one of those women seemed to depend on a man
on something,
in some peculiar way. Yes.
Their motivation was the same as the men. It was political. They were political people. They had ideologies. They had a belief in something that they wanted to fight for. So they were there, and they put their lives on the line in the same way that the men did, and that contribution, I think, has to be recognised in the same way. But actually, interestingly, 2016 has become all about the women. It really has.
It has, in the most amazing way.
Yeah.
Mary, what do you think happened, though? How did they succeed in writing women out of history and so completely?
Well, Anne referred to it, that
yes.
Civil War.
Yes.
The Civil War happened and changed everything. The Cumann na mBan women at that stage get blamed for it. They're seen as bloodthirsty because most of them are anti-treaty. In fact, one of the few who's pro-treaty is Bridget Lyons Thornton. And we talk about the Civil War dividing brother from brother. During the Civil War, Bridget Lyons Thornton was the medical officer in Kilmainham Jail, where most of the women were kept who were anti-treaty. So she was actually a jailer of her erstwhile comrades, her women comrades. It divided friend from friend. The Ryan sisters of Tom Cool, one of whom married Richard McCaughey, two of them married Sean T. O'Kelly. Well, one obviously died before the second one married him. They were both, the sisters were treaty, anti-treaty and pro-treaty. It divided families.
I have noticed this before, Mary. Can you explain that? I mean, I know we're getting a little bit beyond 2016 here,
yeah.
but it has always fascinated me why the women became anti-treaty in such numbers.
Well, they had signed up to fight for a republic in which there would be full and equal citizenship. They didn't get that. And they had committed their lives to that. They had seen family die. They had buried fiancés and sons and husbands and brothers. They had been on the front line of the War of Independence. People talk about the violence of the War of Independence and the fact that the men had gone on the run. Well, the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries visited their violence on the communities, and who was there on the front line in those communities except the women? Their homes were raided at night. The violence that they experienced, we're still only digging into that. Could it have included more sexual violence than we know about? I think the records may give us information that perhaps it did. And we're beginning to do
this?
Research.
Yes.
Some of the research does indicate that. There's certainly, because of the shame and stigma of it all, a lot of women didn't talk about their experiences afterwards. So officially there isn't. But in terms of oral histories and memoirs and hints in the records, there does seem to have been more than we actually would think about. It was a war situation. So these things happen in war. And then what we got was an Irish Free State that was conservative, that was dominated by a Victorian patriarchal ideology and a Catholic Church, which had very much Catholic social thinking, particularly when it came to women and women's position within society. And the proclamation said full and equal citizenship. The 1922 Constitution said that. But immediately you get the Juries Act or the Civil Service Amendment Act or the Conditions of Employment Act. And by 1937, you have the Constitution, the second Constitution, which says a woman's place is in the home.
Okay, we've moved a long way beyond 2016.
Yeah.
Can I just ask you one last question anyway? When the men came back from the Second World War back to Britain, for example, they were put back, the women were put back in mm-hmm. the kitchen equally. So it wasn't just us, was it?
Oh, no, we're not unique at all, unfortunately. It happened throughout the world, and it happened again in the 1950s after the Second World War. You see that as a process. I teach a course called The History of Feminist Politics, and there's always the feminist politics and then the backlash and then another wave. And that's why we call it a wave, because you get the backwash again when the wave goes out and another wave comes in. There's always that response when women take two steps in society or three steps, that then you're pushed backwards, because it is a patriarchy after all.
And where are we now, Mary, in those waves?
I think we're experiencing a little bit of a renaissance of feminism and feminist activism, particularly in this country. And I think, you know, things like Waking the Feminists, things like the same-sex marriage referendum, things like the gender quotas, all that sort of thing is really young women are beginning to realise this isn't the equal society that they thought it was. And particularly the recession brought it home that recessionary politics affect women way more, particularly working class women, particularly poor women, single mothers, lone parents, migrant women, and of course we don't really need to mention the word reproductive rights and full access to reproductive rights. I could go on and on about what we don't have. We've gained a lot, but we don't have... No, we don't have.
But we have a lot more, a little done, lots more to do.
Exactly. We yes. still have a patriarchy. We need to bring that down.
Mary. Mary, that was enthralling. Thank you so much. Mary's book is called We Were There, 77 Women of the Easter Rising. Who published it, Mary?
It's Dublin Public Library's publication for 2016 with them and Four Courts Press.
Excellent. I'm going out to buy it tomorrow.
Thank you so much.
The launch is on March the 8th in Emma by the Lord Mayor of Dublin at probably 5 o'clock, so you're all very welcome.
International Women's Day.
International Women's Day.
Well,
specifically chosen.
Isn't that just excellent?
Mary McAuliffe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, our next guest is no stranger to the Rotunda or to any of you, I suspect, having worked here in the past as assistant master. So this is a bit of a homecoming for her. She's an obstetrician and specialist in fetal medicine, a clinical professor with the RCSI, an Eisenhower Fellow, and the master of Hollow Street. In fact, she's an all-round class swat. I even see it from her writing. She's the first woman to hold that role in the National Maternity Hospital, and you're very welcome to the Women's Podcast, Rona Mahoney.
Kathy, thank you.
And I should say you weren't just the first woman to be appointed master there, you were also the first Northsider.
Well, that's always what I say. In fact, it wasn't about being the first woman, it was, of course, about being the first Northsider from Raheny, Dublin. Absolutely.
Now, isn't that just amazing?
And here I am
Equality
back on the North
all.
Side.
Now, Rona, where were you born?
Yeah, I was born in Knaresford Terrace, actually, with the Gaffney sisters in the Stella Maris. So quite wide, we were talking about nursing homes, and that was very common. A lot of the nursing homes closed in the 70s and 80s, but certainly by the 1930s in Dublin, there was 36 nursing homes in operation. So I guess throughout the 1920s, women began to move from having their babies at home into either hospitals like Hollow Street Rotunda or into a kind of nursing home situation. And then they stayed with us a long time. In fact, Ireland had an incredible amount of hospitals. It still does, relatively. But if we go back to the history of Ireland, I think we had something like, you know, over 100 hospitals in the 1960s, all tiny hospitals, with only one or two having more than 300 beds. But this was quite a common scenario. So there you go.
That is extraordinary. I was trying to remember where I was born for the benefit of my daughter, and it was in the Stella Maris. For some reason, women from the country came up to the Stella Maris and had their babies there. And we all live to tell the tale. Well, some of us did anyway. Rona, you're going to bring us... into the role of Hollow Street in 1916, which was also, when you think about it, in the heart of the city. Mm. What was going on?
So I've always been fascinated because, of course, I suppose if you look at Hollow Street, the very first baby born in 1916 in Hollow Street was a little baby girl. And she weighed 8 pounds, 8 ounces. And her mum was Lily Murphy and her father was John Keogh, but he was a lamplighter. And I just think that's really symbolic because, if you like, the rising, I suppose, you know, if we say it was questionable militarily and success, it certainly flicked that switch that turned the tide of opinion. And as people say, too important to be forgotten. And so the idea of the lamplighter, I suppose, it's right there, isn't it? That whole idea of what flicked the switch and what made us think differently. And so I think it's very symbolic. But, of course, what was very interesting was while the babies were being born, people were coming into the hospital to be treated for gunshot wound. And we treated 40 people, men, women, children, for gunshot wound. And, in fact, the mortuary was filling up with the dead from the streets around. And I think that's something that perhaps the rebels never thought about was the civilian deaths, because almost 500 people died, you know, during 1916. And while the rebels were happy, I think, to sacrifice themselves, I think when they saw children dying and when they saw civilians dying, that was really, really very difficult. And I suppose we have this juxtaposition of the two images, the mortuary filling up with the dead and the babies being born. And so the babies continued to be born. But these babies are very interesting because, of course, they were there for 1916. 16. They saw the foundation of the Free State and later on the Republic of our country. So this generation were fascinating. They were there right at our beginning.
Tell us about Elizabeth O'Farrell, who you mentioned as well. I asked Rona, this is what a swat she is. I asked Rona at the beginning, she mentions her here as being the, she said, that the white flag that would stop the carnage was carried by Elizabeth O'Farrell, who would later train as a nurse and midwife at the National Maternity Hospital. And I said to Rona, is she the woman who was written out of the photographs, who was disappeared out of the photographs? Some of you may remember that story or have seen the images. And do you know what she did? She rang Elizabeth O'Farrell's great-grandnephew.
Grandnephew Ian Kelly, I did.
Just here?
Yeah, I did, just
him.
Now.
Was well, she, yes. Was see, she, right
there,
now?
Yeah, we see there's various stories. One is that she was airbrushed, and this is a big feminist story, you know, like horror, horror. She was airbrushed from the photograph, and all you can see is her foot, and in some photographs, actually, you can't even see her foot. The other is that she stood back because she was a very unassuming kind of person, that she stood back from the photograph, and there's another story that says, in fact, she wasn't there at all during that photograph. She was, in fact, out delivering the surrender. So there you go. So I decided we should get a good opinion. So I went to her grandnephew, Ian, who's an expert, obviously. So he tells me that, in fact, he thinks she was definitely there. She had come, remember the GPO, they decanted to Moore Street before the surrender. So the surrender happened really from Moore Street, and she'd walked up to the corner of Parnell Square. But the English didn't believe they'd send a woman, you know, to surrender. So they didn't believe her. So, and it's a brilliant cartoon by Fergal Carthy. I don't know if you've seen it, the lovely cartoons of 1916, the Little History Museum. And it's this, you know, cartoon, this woman, tiny woman standing there with her arms on her hips, and the English soldiers are going, there's no way they sent a woman, you know what I mean? But anyway, didn't believe her, so she had to go back and get Pierce, and they had to come all the way back again, and that's where, and it's actually a British Army photographer, that's where the photograph was taken, and of course, all you see, I think, is Elizabeth, but she was a very tiny woman, so it's possible that it's slightly just a very poor photographer who just didn't bother, perhaps, capturing
what was
the feminine side of the surrender. Yeah.
What did Ian say? What,
Ian says she was there. No, he says not disappeared. He feels she was there, but just that she's so tiny, in fact, that, you know, you don't actually see her.
Because there was a picture going around the internet, Twitter, I think, with feet. There were
feet, but no
body attached.
And sometimes the hem of a skirt. I mean, there are, so I defer to the family. I mean, Ian's a real expert, obviously.
Right.
But Elizabeth is very interesting. Her dad was a docker, Christopher Farrell. She somehow regained the O, but that's not surprising. That was also a sort of an Irish thing. But she, anyway, obviously had trained, you know, with Cumann na mBun. And I mean, a lot of women really enjoyed, they suddenly had a platform, you know what I mean? They were training, and she probably would have got a lot of her nursing training originally under Kathleen Lynn, and then obviously came back, you know, after the Rising to train as nurse and midwife. But just her tremendous courage, because I mean, as she was walking to give the surrender, she was going from place to place in Dublin. And of course, the English not having believed her, De Valera didn't either, you know, and had to get written evidence that there was a surrender happening. But people were being shot all around her. And at one stage, she was crossing the bridge in Grand Canal, think, and you know, someone was shot dead directly behind her. So she took this enormous risk. But I think at the same time, it's very symbolic that it was a woman who stopped the carnage and that had the courage to go from point to point to point and actually deliver that surrender that did stop the fighting. I mean, the rebels were beat at that stage, there was no doubt about it. They were all being picked off in each of the, it wasn't a brilliantly clever military campaign to take over very obvious places in the city, I suppose, and what, be picked off one by one. It wasn't genius, really, but anyway, that's how it was.
Who knew that? I didn't. Now, Countess Margaret.
Yes.
We're going to move on a bit now, Rona. We're bringing the story on.
Yeah, so I suppose what I feel, well, you know, not what I feel, but I think what's very interesting is, so, you know, we're absolutely right. We've mentioned the proclamation. What was 1916 all about? And we know 77 women arrested, you know, and over 300 women taking part all over the country. But what were they fighting for? This, you know, country that was going to give equal civil rights to women. And you know, did they really get that? And I think although Countess Markievicz made it to the first declared Dáil in 1919, it was actually 22 Dáilí and 1981 before the number of women in our Dáil exceeded 10. And even when we look, you know, at the election that's happening next Friday, yes, we have more, you know, women thankfully standing, but we still have really a huge minority, something like 26 maybe of all the TDs in our Dáil at the moment are women. And if you're having a democracy, I think you need to have a good balance. And so I think it must have been very disappointing for the women who had fought in 1916, been arrested, who had risked their lives, to suddenly see they were written out, you know. And when the Free State came in, you know, it was, as we said, a very conservative, and it was almost like a statement of intent, but all of the first bills that were passed, the Civil Service Examination Bill, you couldn't sit certain exams, the Employment Regulation Bill, you know, God forbid, there'd be a woman in the army and a male telephonist. There was the marriage bar, which only lifted in 1973. Mm-hmm. And then there was, as we said, the jury's bill. You know, and when you think of the cases that were coming across the courts at the time, you know, the Monto was the biggest red light district in area. There was 1,000 prostitutes with a huge problem in Ireland with juvenile prostitution, with rape, with sex abuse. We had the awful vista of huge maternal mortality and indeed infant mortality, 150, you know, babies per 1,000, but particularly those babies born to single mothers. I mean, we reviled single mothers, you know, back then. 1 in 3, I mean, you know, of those children died before the first year of life, half of them in the first 2 months of life. The mothers were absolutely reviled within society, and you know, we had the beginning of women's journey into mother and babies homes, you know, sometimes, you know, slightly milder baby homes for your first offence, which were for women who found themselves having a second baby, the Magdalene, or for the irredeemable women, and always this concept of the fallen women and the upstanding men. But the mortality rate was huge among these children, and I suppose we think also of those poor women who killed their babies. Cliona Ratigan's work, Infanticide, that is a part of our history, and over 300 babies were killed in the first half of our century because women did not have the money or the means or know what to do. Ina P, the woman who killed her baby boy, what else could I do, she said.
What I think one of the interesting things about this is that when you mentioned child abuse way back then in the 1920s, Rona,
yes,
we think it was invented in the 1980s. And that, but when you look back, this was one monstrous element of Irish society,
yes,
that really wasn't uncovered and was then blamed entirely on the church.
Well, you had the Carrigan Commission, I suppose, in the 1920s that looked at a kind of snapshot of sexuality and the age of consent for sexuality, etc. And that found, you know, terrible things, you know, and they were scared to publish that report in case it would contaminate normal people, and they blamed it a lot on the dance hall, you know, and that was 1929. But, you know, we went kind of then, I suppose, we had in the 1930s then a huge influence from our church, and we saw the Eucharistic Congress of 1932, the first big celebration of the Free State, 1 million people coming, John McCormick singing. But, you know, in 1935, we had the Criminal Law Amendment Act, under which contraception became not just an issue of morality, but actually a criminal offence, you know. And that had a huge impact on women's choice surrounding reproduction because, you know, we were also, at the same time, our teaching was coming from the Catholic Church. So culturally, the sort of instruction, teaching we were getting, and also the law, you know, made it very difficult for women to make choice around their family. And there's a health issue with having baby after baby after baby. There's a poverty issue with baby after baby after baby. And this had a tremendous effect on women's ability to get involved in public life, to work, to be independent. And I think, you know, when you think about it, in 1991, Virgin Megastore were prosecuted in this country for selling condoms.
25 years ago. I mean, isn't that just amazing?
Not so long.
Yeah. And yet, Rona, for all that,
yes,
you mentioned Anne Lovett here.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I suppose, you know, when you think of, I suppose, De Valera in the 40s and that illusion we had of, you know, this perfect state that had a very fundamental religious aspect to it and therefore created, you know, the sturdy children of the state and the comely maidens dancing at the crossroads. And you think of what was actually, because in all our sexuality, our earthiness, in all our reality, we were getting on with life. And yet we had this illusion. And I think really 1984, when a 15-year-old little girl died at the foot of a statue of Mary in Granard. And you know Paula Meehan's poem, and she pushed her secret out into the night. And I think just that image, and I think, you know, the next day the radios were hopping Gay Byrne, and for the first time perhaps we spoke truly of our experience, and my goodness, there was so much experience to share. And I think that really shattered any illusion that we wished to have, and we had to begin to face our reality. But I think that was a real turning point.
It was.
In terms...
And what strikes me as you talk, Rona, is that we began with 2016 and the first baby born.
Mm-hmm. Baby girl.
And this is what they were facing in 1916.
Yeah.
We began with 1916,
mm-hmm.
And the babies born then, and what those girls were facing into, I mean, really, life was made very, very difficult for them, wasn't it?
Well, you had this combination, I suppose, of church and state. And I suppose after the criminal law, the best example then was even the mother and child scheme, which is, you know, absolutely fascinating to, you know, read. And the whole idea of the mother and child scheme, it was kind of quite a radical paper produced originally in the Department of Health at the time in 1944-45, Connor Ward. And it was looking at giving all women free maternity care because it recognised, you know, at this stage, even in 1946, the infant mortality in poor areas was about 130 per 1,000, you know, compared to about 26 per 1,000 in more affluent areas. So there was a huge recognition of the need to give care to all people. So there's to be free care, maternity care to women, and also free care for children up to 16. And it wasn't to be means tested. And of course, this brought a huge suspicion, I suppose, the church. I mean, McQuaid's very interesting. I mean, his mother actually died very soon after he was born, and his father remarried less than 2 years later, a lady called Agnes, and he only found out in his late teens that Agnes wasn't, in fact, his real mother, and this had a huge effect on him. But McQuaid had a tremendous interest in women and sexual education, and, you know, a big part of the Mother and Child Act was educating women in reproduction, and McQuaid, there was no way he was having this. In fact, in 1944, he issued an edict that tampons should be banned in the country. Now, you know, how on earth McQuaid even knew about tampons or bothered about them is beyond me. But
good point.
Really. But anyway, and a big part of the church's problem with the Mother and Child Act was, in fact, the issue about education, that the state should not and could not have any role in education, and that this would impact on the rights of the family to sort of, I suppose, a form of privacy, if you like. The other issue was that it wasn't means tested. And then the other issue is that children would be examined, kind of mandatory state examinations. That upset. This is like a form of communism. And what was really interesting, though, was the paper trail between John Costello, who was the Taoiseach of the day, who was literally reporting to McQuaid. And there's a Noel Brown goes to visit, he was summoned to the Archbishop. I think the whole Mother and Child scheme got published a bit prematurely in the Sunday Independent one Sunday. Anyway, he was summoned to the Archbishop's house. But Noel Brown thought the meeting went terribly well. But I think the Archbishop had laid out some very firm markers, and it was very clear. But certainly John Costello was in cahoots. And it was almost like the reporting relationship was the Taoiseach to the Archbishop. And when you think about it, and actually the scheme was defeated. And much of it, and after it was defeated, McQuaid wrote to Archbishop Felici in Rome, who was a kind of a good pal of his, and he felt that he had defended the country from communism, first of all, and that it was the most important event, defeating this, since Catholic emancipation, and that he would be vindicated as someone who sort of saved the state. And that's kind of what we were up against.
That's
folks.
What the poor little babies of 1916 were up against. At the same time, Rona, I notice here in your paper you talk about how the role the Catholic Church played in education and medicine. They played a pivotal role, and you point out that many of the voluntary hospitals that have led the way in Irish medicine were founded by religious orders. That in fact the National Maternity Hospital was founded by a charitable donation from the affluent middle class.
Yeah.
You know, so we have this very strange dichotomy. It's no wonder we're very confused.
I mean, I had an excellent education, I have to say, from the Nuns and Holy Faith in Clontarf, and they were always, one of the big things they always said to us was to be independent, you know, no matter what. I've probably taken that a bit to an extreme, but it's not all bad. But the interesting thing about medicine is, of course, and one of the reasons perhaps there were so many medical students involved in the Rising is that Dublin was one of the few centres that allowed women be educated. You know, all over Europe, probably Dublin and Zurich were the leaders in educating women. Alexander College from the late 1880s was educating women so that they could go to the university. So in that respect, we had a bit of an easier time. But the whole formation of our hospital and our state, you had in the original hospitals were all the parliamentarian grants, and they were the infirmaries, and then you had the Dublin industry hospitals that were the precursor of workhouses, and then benevolence, Catholic emancipation, and then all the benevolence and the voluntary hospitals. So to this day, many of our hospitals, and Hollis Street is one, are not necessarily state hospitals. We are voluntary hospitals. We were founded by people who want charitable organisations. Hollis Street not by a religious order, but by the redoubtable Mrs. Brown, Mrs. Bulger and Canon Fricker and a whole group of characters who felt that there should be a Catholic version of the Lying-In Hospital of the Rotunda, because for Catholic married women, it has to be said,
in
the area.
Yes. bring us up to the war then, Rona, where you talk about how perinatal mortality rates fell due to the advances in medicine.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, it's interesting. Activity was increasing, more people coming into the hospital, but we developed blood transfusion and antibiotics, and that had a profound effect on reducing maternal mortality during the 1940s. And we had a very bad outbreak of gastroenteritis in the 1940s that had a profound effect on our infant mortality temporarily. But there's a lovely story in the 1940s because, of course, you had the ration. The war was going on. Although Ireland not so directly affected, you had all the difficulties with rationing. And De Valera's son, De Valera's a doctor in Holles Street, and anyway, during the, you know, the bombings of North Strand, and it was pretty close to Holles Street, so all the babies were put to safety in the basement, but the mothers were left up in the ward saying the rosary, you know what I mean? And whatever that was about.
I think we know. and as time went on then, new challenges have emerged.
Yeah, so
they were the older ones.
They're the older ones. I think it's been very interesting, you know, when we then go back and we look at the profound, you know, I suppose over those next few decades particularly, we had the advent of ultrasound, you know, in the 80s, neonatal intensive care. So we've seen dramatic advances in medicine that have lowered both maternal and neonatal mortality. And that's been really exciting and a really great story. But now I'm fascinated, you know, when I look at the current demographic of, I suppose, what's happening. You know, we are seeing, I guess, our first-time mums are much older now. We're seeing the difficulties, I suppose, with obesity. But perhaps the biggest one is, you know, the Pope came to Ireland in 1979. And you know the story, like he went to Phoenix Park and then he told everyone to go forth and multiply. In 1980, like we had 80,000 babies in the country, the biggest number.
We all called John Paul, exactly.
But a year before that in England, in 1978, Louise Brown was born. So the first test tube baby. And I suppose now we have all of this assisted reproduction and it's getting technically very complex. So when we look at the attempts at the, you know, children and, you know, family bill, how do you legislate for egg donation, sperm donation? Should you tell children this is their origin? Should you not? Single embryo transfer. Now we have the ability to make pre-genetic diagnosis. Now we can determine a human genome and predict really what that future might be. And these are all huge questions. We can do an ultrasound or a screening test and realize that a baby is going to have very significant challenges. And how are we going to manage that information? So in a way, we go from the censorship of the 1950s, when you think of Edna O'Brien and, you know, her poor mother taking her book and scribbling out all the rule books and putting it in the bottom of the wardrobe and that book being banned. And now we're into the internet where children are learning how to have sex by pornography. Mm. And what way are we wiring these children? This whole jungle that's completely unedited, and how do we manage that? And then from the control of our contraception now to assisted reproduction and all that is possible. And it is such a contrast, if you like, and such a journey where we have come, and so now we have these other challenges. You know, life will always bring you, give you something and take something, but so I just think it's fascinating to go from such restriction now to such possibility. But how does society deal with this, and how do we manage this?
And you were talking, Rona, as well about the great strides in perinatal outcomes, but oddly, Ireland's maternity services, as you say, have lurched from scandal to scandal.
We have, you know, and it's been really, really difficult for women, first of all, and difficult for women at the moment, wondering if they're going to have a baby. What on earth country is this? And, you know, we can say our outcomes are very good, and that's one thing. There's also experience, isn't there? I mean, it's not just about outcome. We can quote our, you know, perinatal figures, but for the one person that's affected, those figures are pretty useless. But I think when you look at it, we have a third of the number of doctors we should have. We're really short midwives in my hospital, about 25. The rotunda's the same. And we have these old buildings that have changed very little. I mean, Holles Street was done up because of a very notorious scheme called the Sweeps, which people may be familiar with, which has, you know, caused havoc in the rest of Europe and caused England to change its entire charity law. Because what the Sweeps was, it was a sweepstake. And anyway, the November Sweeps, Duggan McGrath Spencer, and this big fundraiser had been set up, and tickets had been sold all over the world, but half of them weren't coming back to the Drum. But the millions were rolling in, and all the hospitals were able to do themselves up. And of course, that meant the community care wasn't developed. It was mainly the hospitals. But Holles Street hasn't been done up since that ill-gotten money in the 1930s. Although I'm not sure I wouldn't you know, if someone is out there and they have a good sweeps idea, lottery idea, whatever, I'm not sure I wouldn't be willing to, you know, certainly entertain it anyway, at the very least.
But what's interesting, Rona, is that you reckon that the bigger picture is that we did not pay enough attention.
I believe we did not pay enough attention to birth in this country. It was a women's issue. And even still, there's a tendency to turn off for women's issues. But here's the thing, everybody is born and women's issues actually really matter. And I think it just strikes me as peculiar that we had no voice in the two major institutions of our formation, you know, the Catholic Church and the state, who worked so closely together. And hey presto, we have maternity hospitals that are falling down and we don't have the staff they should have. And I don't think we've ever given maternity or birth enough attention. It is so incredibly important and it's such a cornerstone. It's how our world begins. It's how our society begins. I mean, and I think that's something that I hope that maybe in 100 years' time they will say this was the turning point, you know, this 1916 commemoration when people started to listen to what women were saying and thinking, and all of the childcare issues, which are enormous, and, you know, people say women's things, you know, it's not about women, it's actually about society, and we have to stop relegating. But if I could urge one thing, it is to, you know, birth. It should be right there at the heart of us, and it should be something. And it's not just about the doctors and nurses and the infrastructure in the hospital. It's how do we treat women who are having babies in our society? We should be minding them and nurturing them and gathering round and cooking dinners and doing our bit. This is so special. And I think that we can pay a lot more attention. From the top of the Oireachtas to the government to the Dáil, right down to your next door neighbour. But I think we can do better.
Talk about misogyny in general.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting thing. I was at an amazing meeting called Tourist Naman on Saturday, and Abbot Mark Hederman spoke. Now, I'm a big fan of his. I listen to him often. He's a very wise man. But he gave the most amazing paper, a very intellectual paper and discussion, you know, on this whole issue of gender, feminism, masculinity. And, you know, he really made me stand back. And if you look at societies all over the world, you see there is a patriarchy. And you see that in many societies, not just in ours, and societies still to this day, much worse than ours, where women have really very little voice. And you see where women have poor access to education. And, you know, where you have poor access to education, then any aspiration is easily extinguished because you have not got the tools, you know, to follow on. But, and he talked about, you know, the whole kind of bullying mentality and, you know, everyone's standing, shouting and screaming. And I just thought it was very, very interesting. And I suppose when you stand back, we look at the church, you know, when I say, you know, I'm baptized Catholic and I had a very good education in a Catholic school. And there's a lot about Catholicism that's very good. But why is there no women in leadership roles in the church? How can it be that this entire organization hasn't got a single woman in a leadership role? And what does that say to us?
Rona, but we also have, I don't want to labour this because we are moving a long way beyond the child who was born in 1916, except maybe we're not, because this is what the succeeding generations have been up against and continue to face, as Mary has pointed out here. In terms of misogyny within the professions, you know, we seem to be sort of racing along. Mm. And yet I have talked to very senior women within the medical profession, for example. And they would say, one woman has told me that she wears heels on a tough day around the wards because she feels it gives her a little bit of authority over the men. Mm. It's in her. It's part of her armoury, which I think is rather. Do you recognise that?
I think, you know, it's like that wonderful Guardian article about language surrounding women. You know what I mean? He looks tired because he's working so hard. She looks wrecked because she's not coping. He is really dynamic and forceful in his opinion. She is strident and impossible. She's hysterical. She's everything. You know what I mean? Whereas men are passionate about their cause. You know, men are ambitious, whereas women will kill their mother in order to get what they want, etc. You know, so there is a massive issue surrounding language, and I'm really digressing. But actually, why are we having conversation still about gender quota? Why are we still having a huge issue with lack of representation in our Dáil, which we do? Why do we look at, you know, last Sunday, the Independent, the young girl, you know, on the front cover, you know, sports? Why does the LGFA really struggle to fill Croke Park, and why does nobody want to watch really talented sportswomen? And what is this? So across the strands, we've come a long way. And the one thing we have is our education, and each other. And we have come a long way. But, you know, we have to pass the baton on to the next people. I mean, I remember being fascinated by the condom train, you know, the women going up to Belfast, you know, and getting up there. And apparently they needed a prescription for the pill, which they hadn't got, of course. So they came down with aspirin and condoms, if that's true. But those women, you know, really suffered. They were really, you know, treated very badly by society. And people laughed at feminists and still do. And people hate the idea and still do. And then you're supposed to be a, I know, post-feminist. I don't know what we're meant to be. But anyway, but, you know, those brilliant women who went before me meant that I got to go to school, I got to go to university, and I got all this opportunity. And I would like to think that while we're listening to women's voices in 1916, we are thinking about the next generation of babies. 25 to 30 babies leave Hollis Street every day. And are we thinking about those babies? And it's not just about celebrating women, it's about men as well. How do we all achieve our potential? And how do we make sure that there is fair chance for all of our people to realise the different potentials? And, you know, how do we not have an issue between men and women? How do we make it so there doesn't need to be?
Right, I have one very important question to ask you.
Oh, no, I know this is.
What would you pack in your case if you're going in to have a baby?
I go in to have a baby every day, but I know my mind is blank now. When I had my babies, the most valuable things I had were, well, I'm going to say two things, I'm greedy, but your bag of knickers. So you can go to various stores, I'm probably not allowed to mention them, but Dunn's, whatever, and you can buy a big bag of knickers. You can get 10, they're about €5, €8, and
big
they're reasonably
knickers.
Good cotton, Bridget Jones style, they're reasonably good. But the point is, you know, for that investment, it's not unreasonable around the time you're having a baby to wear and throw out. So that's the first thing. And the same goes perhaps for the nightie. You wear a nightie in labour, because practical reasons, but you need a couple of pairs of pyjamas for after, because that's kind of better, you know what I mean? So that'd be my advice.
She also mentioned a little gin and tonic to me.
Oh, Kathy, I can't believe you.
And she also
on me.
Mentioned chocolate. And you mentioned something else.
I did not.
Right. We leave it there, Rona Manny. Thank you so much for that. That was wonderful. Now, we have these three brilliant women here with us, all of them with a massive amounts of information in their heads, gleaned over many years of study and hard work and diligence and commitment and all of these things, and marvellous role models they are. And I'm wondering, have you learned anything from one another tonight, or did you know all this already, Mary?
Yes, it was very interesting to hear about from the perspective of somebody who's involved in birth. And you're right, I've not thought of it like that. Birth is the most central part, the most important thing that we must think about. And that the female body, the reproductive female body, has been neglected, ignored, regulated, surveilled, imprisoned.
Still being so.
Still being so in lots of ways. The thing I did want to say is Elizabeth O'Farrell was there in the photograph.
Yeah.
And she herself said she stepped back. But her feet, you can see her feet, and they were airbrushed out. But the other point about that is one of the British officers who was there, John Lowe, who was the aide-de-camp to General Lowe, went on to become a Hollywood actor and starred in a film with one of the Abbey actors who actually went out and fought in 1916. So all sorts of connections.
John Loder.
So
yes,
the men
John
did very well out of it.
They did. Yes. But yes, it was fascinating to hear.
Who thought it?
Fascinating to hear that, and fascinating to hear about Mary O'Shea as well and what she saw in 1916.
Anne, have you heard anything new tonight, or is there anything you want to add to any of that?
Well, I think, of course I've learned. You couldn't sit next to a historian and not learn. And Rona's practice is exemplary, but I think the important thing that I take from it, which I probably already knew, is that we're all very fortunate to have had good mothers, as well as good fathers, but good mothers who, and I speak of my own, who didn't see that we couldn't do something, didn't stylize the way we lived or thought, allowed us to have an education and to thrive and to pass it on to our own children if we were fortunate enough to have them. So that in itself is freedom, really, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And a fine tribute to mothers everywhere, including Anne Ingle, who's in the audience, our producer's mother. Rona, what about you? Is there anything left to be said?
Oh, of course. No, I mean, I think it's brilliant, you know, to sit here and listen to these women being celebrated, remembered, but just to listen to their stories and to hear them being brought alive and to think that, you know, you've been interested enough to learn, you know, to bring this to everyone. And, you know, everyone listening in tonight now are going to know these women, and not just the women themselves, but what they stood for, what they did, and their part in this. And isn't it just time? And here we have the women not just mentioned, but we've heard their story. And isn't that just time?
And it all feels as though it's happened very suddenly, doesn't it? I mean, one minute there was not a mention of the women of 1916. And suddenly we realised, thanks to your work, that in fact they were all over the place and it couldn't have happened without them.
Exactly.
And this couldn't have happened without you, Mary.
Well, thank you very much.
Or you, Anne. Or you, Rona. Now, before we go, just a reminder about the Birth of a Nation exhibition that's happening in this wonderful hospital, the Rotunda, from March 7th until March 31st. Admission is free, and you should really try and get to it. The main exhibition takes place in the round room, a sort of hidden space, which the public doesn't get to see, usually. As well as the exhibition, there's a series of lunchtime talks, which will take place from 1:15 to 1:45 p.m. in this room, the Pillar Room, through March, with special guest lecturers providing insights into life at the Rotunda and its medical practice throughout 1916. The one we're looking forward to is by former Irish Times journalist Pádraig Yates, who will be overseeing a conversation titled "The Women Are Worse Than the Men: Crime in Dublin, 1916, Mark It Down." It takes place on Thursday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. For more information, visit www.rotunda.ie/1916. And you'll find them on Twitter at Rotunda Hospital, all one word. And finally, we need to tell you this week's podcast question. March 8th, next week, is International Women's Day, and we will obviously be celebrating that date here in the Women's Podcast. The Irish Times has a special magazine planned celebrating the most influential Irish women around the world. So our question to you is this: who is the most influential woman in your world? It can be anyone at all. It could even be your mother, Sarah. Especially your mother, Anne. Because it's also Mother's Day on Sunday, March the 6th, in case you'd forgotten. And our producer, Roisin Ingle, has an excellent book out, here it is, called The Daughterhood, written with Natasha Fennell, which would make an excellent Mother's Day present if you're looking for an alternative to the usual flowers and chocolates and big knickers and gin and tonics and all that sort of thing. Thank you to all our guests. Thank you to Heathers, Anne O'Byrne, Mary McAuliffe and Rona Mahoney for their fabulous contributions. We'd also like to thank the Abbey Leagues Heritage Trust for permission to use Mary O'Shea's memoir. Thank you also to Una Mullally, Orna Mulcahy, Dominique McMullen, Ciara Kenny and everyone at the Irish Times who helped in so many different ways to bring this event together. And of course to the Rotunda Hospital for inviting us into this great institution and being such generous hosts. Thank you all for listening. The podcast is produced by Roisin Ingle, researched by Erin Maguire, and JJ Vernon is on sound. I'm Cathy Sheridan, and I'm going to leave you now with another piece of music, this time from the Bugle Babes, who for one night only are being rebranded as the Bugle Babies, given the podcast that's in it. The Bugle Babies are harmonising trio Eileen Coyle, Darby Brown, and Lou Van Lacka. Where were you born, Bugle Babies?
Well, I was born under an apple tree.
Oh, under a cherry tree, me.
And a lilac tree.
I love them Bugle Babies. I always wanted to be a Bugle Baby.
That's why we sing.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me.
Right, thank you for listening. We really hope you enjoyed this Birth of a Nation broadcast. Here are the Bugle Babies with a lullaby of Broadway. I always wanted to be a Broadway baby. Listen to the words of this song.
Come on, lie and listen to the lullaby of Broadway. The hip hooray and ballyhoo, the lullaby of Broadway. The rumble of a subway train, the rattle of a taxi, the daffodils who had
entertain at Angelo's and Maxie's when the Broadway baby says goodnight. It's early in the morning. Manhattan babies don't sleep tight until the dawn. Good night, baby. Good night. Milkman's on his way. Sleep tight, baby. Sleep tight. Let's call it a day. Listen to the lullaby of old Broadway. The band begins to go to town, and everyone goes crazy. You rock by your baby round till everything gets hazy. Hush, bye, I'll buy you this and that. You hear your daddy saying, a baby goes home to her flat to sleep all day. Good night, baby. Good night. Milkman's on his way. Sleep tight, baby. Sleep tight. Let's call it a day. Listen to the lullaby of old Broadway.
Thank you.